It's good to see everybody here today. If you are visiting with us for the first time, then we encourage you to please fill out a visitor's card. At the end of our service, there will be an opportunity to place that in a basket as it comes by. We would love to reach out to you and find out if you have any spiritual needs. If you're in the area, then we would love to sit down and have a Bible study with you and present to you the simple gospel message and answer any questions that you have about God, about the Bible, and about the faith that He has asked to grow within all of His people. Do you ever have any great realizations or revelations in the strangest places? What's your place that you go to think about things or to ponder things, to get new ideas or roll old ideas around in your head? Without being too strange, mine is the shower. There's something about being in the shower, maybe after a long run or a hard workout, relaxing your muscles, where you just are able to think about things and process things and go through ideas. Maybe that's why our water bill is so high every month. But I was in the shower the other day after a long workout, relaxing my muscles in the hot water, and it was the water itself that was the big realization that day. I turned around and I stared not into the water itself. Really hurt my eyes. But I stared at the water coming out in this perfect stream, crystal clear, clean water. And I thought, any time of day that I feel like having a drink of water, I could just turn a knob and it comes out of a tap. Effectively, an infinite amount of water. Not literally, but effectively, an infinite amount of water at my disposal. When I feel like bathing in it, I bathe in it. When I feel like playing in it, I fill up a pool and play in it. When I want to wash my clothes or wash my car, we have so much water in the middle of the Sonoran Desert that we grow bright green lawns in our backyard and we send our kids out to play in giant pools of it. And what a blessing it is. What a real blessing it is to have access to clean water. You might say that we are luckier than some, luckier than most, in fact, when it comes to our access to water. And don't worry, the sermon's not about clean water. But I need to use this as a jumping off point to something else. In our world, 85% of the human population lives in the driest half of the planet. 783 million people do not have access to clean water. 783 million people. 2.5 billion people do not have access to adequate sanitation. In fact, more people on planet Earth own a mobile phone than have a toilet in their homes. Jesus even reminded his listeners in the first century that if you have a cup of cold water to spare somebody, you're doing better than a lot of other people out there. Remember what he said in Matthew chapter 10, verse 42, that whoever in the name of a disciple gives to one of these little ones even a cup of cold water to drink, truly I say to you, he shall not lose his reward. And if you have even a single cup of water to spare somebody else, that means you are doing better than at least one other person in this world. And it's such a small blessing, isn't it? It's such a small blessing to have a cool drink of clean, safe water. That's more than Jesus had on the cross. We read in the story of the cross that at one point, very near the end, all he wanted was just a sip of water. He said, "I am thirsty." And the best that they could come up with was sour wine on a sponge at the end of a stick. So if you have a cup of water in front of you, you have more than Jesus did on the cross. That is a blessing. And you are luckier than many people. But at the heart of it, what is luck? Have you ever hear the term the life lottery thrown around? What people mean by the life lottery is that when you're born in the United States of America, in the most prosperous time in the United States of America, and when it comes to your personal economy or your social status, you're born into a wealthy or well-to-do or successful family where college is the norm and it's expected of you to succeed, You have every physical capability at your disposal. You can walk, you can talk, you can see. You're healthy, you're wealthy, you're young, and your social status reflects it. You were born into the life lottery, is what some people say. And there are people who are born into the life lottery. There are people who have a lot of things at their disposal, many blessings that you could say, that person is luckier than some. That person is luckier than most. Now, the first reaction that some people might have in that situation is to feel guilty about it. And perhaps you find yourself in that situation. If I was to level with you, and I'm not gloating, and I'm not making a joke in any way, didn't I win the life lottery? And I'll speak bluntly with you. Being born into an upper middle class American white family, where my parents helped me pay for college, and I was raised in a very happy environment, with parents who loved me and loved each other and loved God and taught me the gospel from day one. I don't really have any excuses, do I? If I fail somehow in life, I won the lottery. Everything that you could want about a life, I feel like I have. So why do I feel bad about it? Why do I watch the news and feel bad that my life is so good when Syrian children are being gassed to death? And why do I feel so bad about my life when I don't have to go across the world but only look in certain neighborhoods in this city and realize that people don't have air conditioning? They don't have a sense of safety? They don't have anybody to depend on or who depends on them in a loving way? They don't have family or friends? They suffer from addiction, broken relationships, sin of all kinds, and here I am, and I feel guilty. Do you? I hope I'm not the only one who feels a little bit of guilt at how lucky I am. Now, maybe you're on the other side of it. Maybe you're not lucky. Maybe you didn't win the life lottery, and you were born into a family that was broken, and you have health difficulties that don't seem to ever go away. And you've always struggled with money or with debt. And maybe you look at a person like me and go, "Don't feel guilty, buddy. Appreciate what you have, because a lot of us in the world don't have it." And there are hundreds of millions of people out there who don't even have a tap from which to get clean water. And the water they get is from a muddy puddle filled with disease and bacteria. And every time they take a drink of water, they're risking their lives, literally. So I spend a lot of time in different lessons talking about sin and struggle and persecution, trials, health difficulties and broken relationships, and yes, sin and what it does to our lives. But I want to spend today's lesson, just today, talking a little bit to the lucky ones, to the people who don't struggle in life, and to the people who don't face persecution, and to the people who do seem to, at least on the outside, have it all. I want to talk to you today. And let's keep in mind something, that no matter what position you are in, poor or rich, healthy, sick, young or old, white or black, no condition is permanent. And in the afterlife, we will not have skin color, and we will not have money, and we will not have social or economic classes or status. In the afterlife, all you have is you and your soul. So there is no permanent situation. There is nothing eternal except who you are and what you've done with this life. And we need to remember that. As the book of Proverbs puts it, when you love wealth, you'll be disappointed by it, because wealth certainly sprouts wings and flies away like an eagle. And poverty doesn't last forever either. Because just like the poor man Lazarus was carried away by angels in his death, and Abraham said of him, "You received your good things in this life, and he received his bad things, and now he's being comforted." Even poverty is not permanent. So let's talk about the lucky ones a little bit. We need to be careful, first of all, how we use the word lucky. We like to throw it around pretty casually. Oh, you're real lucky. Oh, you got a new job? You're very lucky. Oh, you're healthy and wealthy? You're very lucky. Oh, you're so lucky to have the spouse that you do, to have the children that you do. You're so lucky to have such great elders at Monte Vista. We're so lucky. We need to be really careful about the word luck and what lucky really means. Because some things are just time and chance, and maybe you can call them luck. Maybe it's just a semantic issue. But in Ecclesiastes chapter 9, verses 11 and 12, Solomon talks about the way that the race doesn't always go to the swift, and the battle doesn't always go to the strong, and wealth doesn't always go to people who are discerning. Time and chance, coincidence, maybe call it luck if you want to use that term, it happens to us all. So yes, that is true. But even things that seem lucky at first might come with a very costly catch. Go to Ecclesiastes chapter 5. And by the way, we're going to look at several passages from Ecclesiastes. So if you've got a bookmarker, go ahead and mark Ecclesiastes. But for now, let's notice Ecclesiastes 5 beginning in verse 10. He who loves money will not be satisfied with money, nor who loves abundance with its income, because this too is vanity. When good things increase, those who consume them increase. So what is the advantage to their owners except to just look on? I think to look on helplessly is what he means. Now, maybe put yourself in the shoes of the person that you envy. The lucky ones out there, the people who have all the money and they've got the job that you want and the house that you could only dream of. But the problem is, when you get the big house, you've got to pay the security system. You've got to have the security provider. So that's one more person who's taking money from your life. And when you get so much money, you can't balance a checkbook the way normal folks balance a checkbook. You've got to hire an accountant. And of course, that accountant has to have a team of accountants. So that's more moochers in your life taking from you. And then, of course, there are your children. And I cannot imagine what it would be like to be a billionaire with small children wondering every single day, is this the day my kids get kidnapped and held for a $100 million ransom? So you've got to hire Dwayne The Rock Johnson to be your security guard. So that's somebody else that's taking from you. By the way, dream on, right? I think he's a pretty expensive bodyguard. But as good things increase, those who consume them increase. You find yourself, yes, surrounded by money, but more importantly, surrounded by a whole class of moochers ready to take your money. But then he says this in verse 12. He says this in verse 12, which is a good reminder to people. The sleep of the working man is pleasant, whether he eats little or much, because he's put in a full day. He's put in an honest day of work, and he can go to bed, put his head on his pillow, and feel good about it. But the full stomach of the rich man does not allow him to sleep. Ice cream at 11:30 at night? Made that mistake, friends. Yet I keep making it. And the full stomach of the rich man bothers him throughout the night, and he doesn't get a good night of sleep. These are good reminders for us, right? That things sometimes come with a catch, and if you get rich, well, watch out. Being rich isn't all what it's cracked up to be. Rather than seeing health, wealth, or your opportunities as mere luck or coincidence, we should take the approach that all things can and should be used to serve God. And I believe that this is what the point is in James chapter 1, verses 17 and 18. Sloan already read it earlier in our worship service, so we'll just sum it up now. All the good things that we have in this life, they come from God. And God intends for us to take those good things, to appreciate them, and to use them in His service. And there are other passages that we'll look at later on in our lesson to that point as well. Now, that doesn't literally mean that every time you find a good parking spot at the mall, that God somehow got you that parking spot. But this is a general rule that says life in general is full of good and beautiful things. Life in general has many blessings. And all of those blessings come at their ultimate source from God. God is the one who created the sun that makes all of life possible on planet Earth. God is the one who created every molecule that provides water for us. God is the one who has created a planet with gravity that makes things possible. God is the one who, at the source of it, has created all these things for us to enjoy. One comedian put it really well. when he was summing up life, saying, you do realize that the basic package, right? You know, like basic cable package. The basic cable package of life on planet Earth is pretty awesome. Because for a billion miles in every direction, you have nothing but the vacuum of space. The very worst life on planet Earth is still better than a day on the moon. Without a spacesuit, that is. That's pretty cool for your base package of life on planet Earth. Of course, he goes on to say that you can eat bacon. Anybody can eat bacon. And bacon makes life on planet Earth worth it. I don't know about that for sure, but we did just study Acts chapter 10 in Bible class. It's a joke. Now, having abundance is not necessarily a sign that God even approves of any of the things that you do in life. There are evil people who are plenty wealthy, and there are good people who struggle financially. So if you are one of the lucky ones, be careful not to assume that just because you have health, wealth, youth, and all these opportunities, that that must be God's sign of approval for however it is that you are living. But what if I can't help but feel guilty when I look at all the things around me, all the opportunities I have, all the luck that I've run into in my life? Well, let's go back to the book of Ecclesiastes, back to chapter 5. And let's notice something here as we keep reading in the text in Ecclesiastes 5, beginning in verse 13. And we'll go through the end of the chapter. Ecclesiastes 5, 13 through the end of the chapter. There's a grievous evil which I've seen under the sun. Riches being hoarded by their owner to his hurt. When those riches were lost through a bad investment, and he had fathered a son, then there was nothing left to support him. As he had come naked from his mother's womb, so he will return as he came. He will take nothing from the fruit of his labor that he can carry in his hand. And this also is a grievous evil. Exactly as a man is born, thus will he die. So what is the advantage to him who toils for the wind? That's a good question. But God is going to give us something through the writer Solomon, something to remember, a little silver lining that you have to keep in mind. If you are somebody who has many blessings, material blessings, remember this. Here is what I have seen to be good and fitting. To eat, to drink, and enjoy oneself in all one's labor in which he toils under the sun during the few years of his life which God has given him. For this is his reward. Furthermore, as for every man to whom God has given riches and wealth, he has also empowered him to eat from them and to receive his reward and rejoice in his labor. This is a gift from God, for he will not often consider the years of his life because God keeps him occupied with the gladness of his heart. Now, what that's saying is, not that if you have wealth, that means God likes everything you're doing in life, or that that wealth is a sign that you must be living right with God. Job's story shoots that whole theory in the foot, doesn't it? But what it's saying is, if you happen to be wealthy, it's okay. You're not a sinner. If you happen to have material blessings, you don't have to feel bad about that. You don't have to feel bad about the house that you bought. You don't have to feel bad that your car might be nicer than a lot of other people's cars. You don't have to feel guilty about that. The real question boils down to, are you keeping God in the mix? And is your wealth being used to glorify Him? Are you keeping God in the mix? And is your wealth being used to glorify Him? That goes back to chapter 2, by the way. Go to Ecclesiastes chapter 2 and verse 24 now. It says something very similar to chapter 5, but with one extra wrinkle. It says, there is nothing better for a man than to eat and drink and tell himself this labor is good. This also I have seen that it is from the hand of God, for who can eat and who can have enjoyment without Him? All right? Now, I think you have to read that as a companion to chapter 5. Because if you read chapter 5 just by itself, you might walk away thinking, well, yeah, God told me, if I'm rich, just live it up and have a good time. But chapter 2 is saying, don't forget about God. Because can you eat and can you drink and can you have any material blessing at your fingertips and be happy without God in your life? We know the answer is unequivocally no. Moving on to our next point. The thing that makes enjoyment possible is a God and neighbor focused approach to our wealth. Being wealthy is not a problem, but hoarding it to your own self-destruction is a problem. It's not a sin to have a comfortable life or to be born in a time and a place surrounded by blessings and opportunities. It's how you use them. Have you put those things into service somehow? Go to 1 Timothy chapter 6. In the New Testament, one of the great passages on the subject, that if you are a wealthy person, don't forget to read 1 Timothy 6, verses 17 through 19, every single day. Every time you see your bank balance, every time you take that nice car out, every time you look at your body and it is healthy and it is young and you have at your disposal abilities and talents and skills and youth, read 1 Timothy 6. Instruct those who are rich in this present world not to be conceited or to fix their hope on the uncertainty of riches, but on God. Notice that being rich isn't the problem. It's not a sin to be rich. It's the attitude. But to focus on God, who richly supplies us with all things to enjoy, instruct them to do good, to be rich in good works, to be generous and ready to share, storing up for themselves the treasure of a good foundation for the future, so that they may take hold of that which is life indeed. And that is the sense that you get from some of the people in the Bible who were rich, but at various times, like in Solomon's case, kept God at the forefront and made him a priority. More particularly, you see in the examples of people like Job, or Barnabas, or Joseph, or Esther, or Boaz. These were all very successful people who had incredible wealth at their disposal. But they're all very noble characters. People admired them, and God loved them. Not because they were wealthy, but because they were wealthy in spirit. Take Esther, for example, and I'll sum up the story of Esther. We don't have time to read the book of Esther. But Esther was known as Hadassah, a young Jewish woman in exile in Persia. And through a course of events that were completely out of her control, she finds herself confronted with the king, the emperor of the known world, Ahasuerus. Now, she has certainly lived a life that was worthy of spiritual praise, and she was also physically very beautiful. In fact, that was what Ahasuerus was looking for most of all, was the most beautiful person in his empire to be his new wife. And through this series of challenges, whatever it was that the eunuchs put her through, I don't know, but through these series of challenges, she found herself one night with the king, and impressed him enough that she became his queen. A nobody, a poor Jewish exile. And she is now the queen of the most powerful empire that the world had ever seen up to that point. Was it a sin for her to be queen of the empire? Was it a sin for her to wear expensive clothes or to wear a golden crown? Was it a sin for her to have that position? Was it a sin for her to be incredibly physically attractive? Did she have to feel guilty about all of these blessings, being that they were material blessings, many of them completely out of her control? No, she didn't have to feel guilty about them. In fact, a time came when it was because she was in that position that she could do the most good. When a plot was discovered against her people, the Jews, she knew that she had to step in. And her uncle Mordecai made it clear that you're the only person right now who can do this. But you know what? If you don't do it, if you don't do something, if you don't step up, God will move on. And he'll find somebody else who can step in and help. Deliverance might come for the Jews from some other place, but you have the opportunity to be that deliverance right now. And it was because she was in that position. It was because she was, quote unquote, one of the lucky ones in the empire that she could make a difference. Which leads me to this point. Perhaps you were made strong for such a time as this. Don't feel guilty if you're young and healthy. Don't feel guilty if you have material blessings at your disposal. Maybe you are young and healthy and wealthy and have many opportunities so that you can help others who don't. Perhaps the reason why you are so strong, the reason why you're so lucky, is so that you can be a blessing to somebody else. So that the strong can carry the burdens of the weak. And someday, when the roles are reversed, when your life has changed and you're the weak one, those who are strong can help carry you. That was true for Esther. It was true for a guy like Barnabas. True for some others as well. God does not do our charity for us, and we need to remember that. God is not going to write your check for you. God is not going to help somebody move into a new house. God is not going to feed that homeless person. God's main concern is our holiness and our salvation. That is His job. It is His job to make the way possible for us to go to heaven. And He's not going to do our charity on planet Earth for us. We need to remember that it is our responsibility to be the hand that helps, to be the one that brings the food. That when we read in Matthew chapter 25, as Jesus so eloquently puts it, on that day of judgment, when those on the right and those on the left are separated, the sheep from the goats, and everybody starts wondering, well, how did I end up on the right and how did I end up on the left? And Jesus will look at those, the sheep on the right, He'll say, when you fed them and you clothed them and you gave them something to drink, where's the responsibility? Who did it? Who did the feeding? Who did the clothing? Who gave them a cup of cold water to drink? Us. Our hands did it. Our hands did it. And even Jesus acknowledged in John chapter 12, verse 8, quoting from Deuteronomy 15, even Jesus acknowledged that the poor you will have with you always. That is simply a reality of life on planet Earth, a place that has been broken by sin and cursed. The poor you will have with you always. So God asks us to be the ones to practice charity, especially among our brethren. Galatians 6 and verse 10, do not grow weary in doing good, especially to those of the household of faith. Charity is an expression of our religion in James chapter 1, verse 27. If you want to show that you're a truly religious person, well, you help the widow, and you help the orphan, and you keep yourself unstained by sin. And Paul explains that this is the way it's supposed to be in 2 Corinthians chapter 8. Please turn with me there at this time. And notice the way he describes it in 2 Corinthians chapter 8. Speaking of this charitable effort, of resources that were being pooled by congregations and then delivered to Judea to help the brethren there. Now, each individual congregation was gathering its own funds and then sending it by way of messenger to Judea. But there was still this sense of this is a collective effort in spirit. That each congregation will, on its own and independently, make some contribution to the needy saints in Judea. But we're all in this together. So he's comparing the work of the Corinthians to the work of those who are in Macedonia, the churches of Macedonia, and the church that is in Corinth. And he has this to say near the end of the chapter, beginning in verse 12, about halfway through. For if the readiness is present, that is in you, the desire to help in Judea, if the readiness is present, he says, it is acceptable according to what a man has, not according to what he does not have. For this is not for the ease of others and for your affliction, but by way of equality. Now, the Macedonian churches struggled, and you can read about that in the first few verses of chapter 8. The Macedonian churches struggled. They did not have a lot of resources, but what they had was desire. They didn't have a lot of money, but they had zeal, and they had love, and they had excitement for the work. So even though what Macedonia could not contribute, or even though what Macedonia could contribute was not much in terms of the monetary value, and maybe Corinth could contribute more in monetary value, look what Paul has to say. At this present time, he says in verse 14, your abundance being a supply for their want. You have a lot, Corinth. You have a lot. But churches like in Macedonia, they don't have a lot. And churches down in Judea who are suffering from a famine, they don't have a lot either. But your abundance becomes a supply for their want by way of equality. And in verse 14, at this present time, your abundance being a supply for their want, that their abundance also may become a supply for your want, that there may be equality. As it is written in the book of Exodus chapter 16, he who gathered much did not have too much, and he who gathered little had no lack. And you see that played out in the early church in Jerusalem. In the book of Acts chapter 4, for example, in verses 32 through 37, none of those who had wealth and property considered their wealth as their own, but everybody who had abundance, materially speaking, shared with all of those who did not have material abundance. That way everybody had something. Practical applications, then, as we bring our lesson to a close. If your marriage is strong, then good for you. You're not lucky, by the way. You're not lucky if your marriage is strong. I know from my own parents, from my grandparents, from people I've talked to here and in other places, that if you have a strong marriage, it wasn't just blind luck or accident. You have a strong marriage because you worked for it. So if you have a strong marriage, don't consider yourself lucky and then feel bad that other people out there have marriages that are failing. No, you take your strong marriage and help other people. You be the example, you teach them, you love them, you guide them. Take younger couples aside and teach them the things that you wish you had known when you were a younger couple. If you are strong in that area, let your abundance in your marriage supply the want in somebody else's marriage. Use your physical strength to help others. I think this is a good point. In the book of Galatians chapter 6, it says that those who are strong ought to bear the burdens of those who are weak. And I believe he's talking about spiritual things more than just material things. But let's be literal about it. And if you are physically strong, don't miss an opportunity when somebody's moving to another house, when somebody's moving to an apartment, even if it's on the second floor. Stop doing that, by the way. By the way, stop doing that. But if you're physically strong, use that strength in some way to help somebody else. Be there for people when yard work needs to be done. Be there for people when housework needs to be done. Be there for people when a concrete needs to be poured or a backyard needs to be turned upside down. Be there for people. You have physical strength, and some of us don't. That was a joke. Come on. You're supposed to say, no, Ryan, it's a lot of strength that's just spread out over very long arms. Use your spiritual maturity as an example for the weak. Romans chapter 15, verse 1. A wealth of knowledge that is stored away is useless knowledge, my friends. And if you're rich in Bible knowledge, don't just sit around with it in your brain. Use it. Share it. Spread it. Share your wealth. And we've talked enough about this already. But share your wealth without any expectation of repayment. Because the measure that you use will be used to judge you. And I love the way that Jesus put it. I do want to read this one in Luke chapter 6 in verse 38. Such an eloquent way to put it. So tangible. You can almost see the cup overflowing in your mind's eye as Jesus says, give and it will be given to you. Good measure, pressed down, shaken together, running over, they will pour into your lap. For by your standard of measure, it will be measured to you in return. And have you lived a kind of life that could be described in that way? And learn to be okay with who you can help. In the world of all this information, where all we have to do is look on the internet, turn on the news, listen to the radio, and we have all of this information about atrocities all over the world, needs all over the world. Yes, we can do what we can to help. But the greatest need that we have is in our own community, the people around you. Jesus told us to love our neighbor as ourself. And while you can say in this universal sense that all of mankind is your neighbor, nobody is more your neighbor than your neighbor. Help the people who are in your life. Help the people you can help. Because if you're not rich, there's people around the world that you're not able to help. And if you don't know somebody, it might be very, very hard to help them when their marriage fails. Don't get so fixated on the people all around the world who are starving, on people who don't have access to clean water. They need help, and we hope that their own neighbors will help them. But I think we need to focus on the things that we can do. Remember, the Good Samaritan, when he found that man dying on the side of the road, he found him. He didn't go looking for him, but he found him. Pure coincidence, providence, brought that dying man into the Good Samaritan's life. And when the opportunity was there to help an individual, the Good Samaritan helped. The Good Samaritan was one of the lucky ones. He was not attacked by marauders on the road. He had the wealth and the material blessings to help this individual. He was one of the lucky ones. And he shared that luck with someone else. Let's do the same thing. You can't fix every problem in the world, but you might be able to help fix your neighbor's problem. Now, if you're not a Christian here this morning, you really ought to be. You need to start living the life of the Christian, the life that's laid out in the gospel. It's a beautiful life. It's a wonderful life. And at its end is heaven forever. So whatever need you might have, please let it be known by coming forward as we stand and sing.